You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my new series, Parrish. My character, Gray Parrish, was a getaway driver.
I'm retired from life. You know that.
He's in a world over his head.
Tell me about this driver job.
And he's asked to start to figure things out.
I did what you told me to.
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC+.
Holy Human with Leanne Rimes is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome, my friends, to this very special episode of Holy Human. I mean, they are all very special to me, but this one is one of my favorites. And I say that with every new episode. Writer Steph Jagger burst onto the literary scene with her adventurous 2017 memoir, Unbound, A Story of Snow and Self-Discovery. In her latest work, Everything Left to Remember, My Mother, Our Memories, and A Journey Through the Rocky Mountains, she navigates the emotionally rocky landscape of her mother's battle with Alzheimer's disease. Today, Steph joins me for a wide-ranging, intimate, and vulnerable conversation about her mother, Mother Earth, female archetypes, and so much more on this very special episode of Holy Human. Now, before we start, I was just reading on your website just about you, and I love that you said, I'm scared often.
I am that was my scared favorite. Often. I am scared often. Yeah, how
too.
Do we get comfortable there, right?
Fuck, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. Right. I'm always scared going into interviews.
Yeah.
And especially with your book, because there's so many things that are very specific that I wanted to touch on and things that you've written that were so incredibly poetic and stunning. It's such a beautiful book. So thank you for joining me on this podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm really deeply honored to kind of co-create something
here. Yeah, absolutely. I love that both of your books, Everything Left to Remember and Unbound, are both about the adventurous journey. You know, I travel all the time, of course. And I just wondered, what do you think it is about travel that helps us discover ourselves?
I think for me, starting with the very early travel that I did kind of right out of university, really, I discovered that I was no one but me. There was no role to play other than me. You know, when you travel, and a lot of the traveling I did was traveling on my own. And so I wasn't someone's sister. I wasn't someone's daughter. I grew up in a place that my grandparents went to the same high school that my parents went to that I went to. So I wasn't anyone's granddaughter or little sister, et cetera, which allowed me to then, I think, practice showing up as me, as authentically me, without having to fulfill those roles. And I think I was, you know, some of the people that I've met on my travels have been people that I've had sustained relationships with over time, because I think they probably had a clearer sense of who I was just based on me feeling the freedom to show up as, you know, a naive traveler in the world.
I love that. I have never had that experience of travel. My travel has been very, very different. When you say that you get to basically be more of yourself and you could be whoever you want to be, really, you know? And for me, it's been so interesting because I'm showing up as me
It's probably the opposite. Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting. Yeah. I love hearing that though. Maybe I just need to put on a wig and show up. Right.
I think some of it is maybe there's a broader question of travel or not, where is it that I feel I have the deepest access to my own internal world and can kind of like pull that forward? And that may be travel for some people, that may be inside of their families for other people, that may be in kind of more private inner sanctums for others. And I think that's the kind of largest question is, where did I feel as though I was encouraged to access a larger internal landscape and kind of bring that forward?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, that's nature.
Yeah.
And I know you talk a lot about nature. In fact, I'm going to just jump to this question because one of the things that I've been exploring is more nature and being in tune with animals and just exploring what that brings out in me. But I find myself so resistant to it. Mm-hmm. And in your book, you said the truth meets you in nature, which is why it's sometimes hardest to go, which brings me to tears. I just wondered if you had any words of wisdom on the resistance to her, because I feel like there's some resistance there for me.
Yeah, I think certainly that line, like the truth meets you there, there's probably a couple of things I would think about. Number one would be, I think it is hard sometimes for us to go because nature can't be anything other than it is. Mm-hmm. A cedar tree can't one day wake up and be like, you know what, I feel like I need to like put on a bit of a mask this morning and like play the role of an alder. Like, it just can't do that. Really the only, you know, raven or maybe the only exception, they can throw their voice. But outside of that, you know, I think one of the most confronting things is we're not used to that as humans, as mm-hmm. walking up to another human being and kind of going, this is exactly the essence of who this person is, and they can't change it, and they can't mask it, and they can't be something they're not, and they can't pretend, and they can't. So I think it's really confronting sometimes to go into nature to go, it is going to show me its rawest, truest identity and essence, and it's going to ask me to do the same. And there's very, very few places that we're asked to do that. In fact, most often we're asked to do the opposite. Like, most often we're like, could you just play this role for me? Mm-hmm. You know? I'd really prefer that if you just play this role for me. So I think that's confronting. I think the other part of nature and wilderness that is confronting, and I think especially so for women, is, you know, we've been taught that nature is a wild, scary, dark place. Mm-hmm. And that things there are feral and untamed and there's beasts in the woods, et cetera. And so we shouldn't go there. And I think that's just a direct example of what we've been told about our own bodies.
Oh, yeah. I was just thinking, our nature, that's exactly what it's been.
That's right. And so I think actually what we're more scared of is meeting the kind of internal, feral, messy, wild kind of howling parts of ourselves that we've been told we have to tame. Mm. And so when we go into nature, and again, we're kind of confronted by that, I think it's easy for us to mask and say, that's the scary thing, that external thing. When in fact, I think it's our own interiority that we haven't been encouraged to explore and trespass through. Like, it feels like trespassing, which is ridiculous, right? Because it's our own bodies and our own selves. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons that nature's been so, so, so powerful for me is kind of to go, am I scared of that noise, or am I scared of the feeling it brings up inside of my body that I am so deeply uncomfortable by? And why is it that I'm so deeply uncomfortable with feelings in my body?
Yeah. Yeah. When I go into nature, even if it's just during the daytime, like out in our backyard, I find that that's where I'm not with my phone. I'm not with anything. And it's I think it is. I think you're right. It brings up whatever comes up at that moment in time, can be really confronting and uncomfortable because I'm just being with nature and my own nature.
Yes.
And that can be, yeah sometimes I just, sometimes we all want to run away from that, but
right?
It is, it's a beautiful dance. Thank you for that. Yeah. That really jumped out at me because I know sometimes it's hard for me to just get myself outside and just be with ultimately me.
Yes. That's exactly it. I mean, it's like, are we scared of the nature out there or are we scared of our human nature? that's always been, a big question for me. And I think, to use nature as a guide for that. You also referred to, in your question, like, what is it about her, right? As in Mother Nature.
Yeah.
And I think there are so many of us that when we think about mother, that can be a complex, scary, negative, kind of fraught relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's been the relationship with our own mother, why on earth would we want to have a relationship with the mother?
Whew. Yeah, when you put it that way.
Right. I mean, this is what, if you flip this quite often, if you think about this in a religious context, this is why many men, I think, have deep issues in religious because priests are called father. So if you've had a negative relationship with father, how on earth am I going to get to a place where I could trust the big father?
Oh, yeah. So these are questions I ask myself all the time.
Right.
For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. 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 So I think that's a learning and a, for me, really, the question is whether it's remothering or continued mothering, there is a question there of how do I, if there wasn't trust inside of my own relationship with my mother or inside of my own relationship with my own mothering of self, how do I get to the place with nature where there can be trust between her and I?
Wow, you just broke that down for me really well. I feel so seen because I've been going through that with my own self of like, I did some work the other day where I was revisiting my inner child and what came out was that that piece of me didn't trust me. And so, yeah. And then tying nature into that and then tying my own mother's, the relationship with my mother into that, where I don't run to my mother for solace and comfort. And so, yeah. And I think I've had a lack of trust around Mother Nature of like, when people say, let the earth hold you, like it will, it can hold every, I'm like, it's bullshit.
Right?
And
right?
So,
yeah.
But I recognize that I so deeply desire that. And I think sometimes I think what's coming up for me around nature is grief because recognizing that I so deeply desire to be held by the mother.
Yeah.
And starting to hold my own child, starting to be able to be held by nature is a journey.
Yeah. There's something coming up for me just as we're talking about this, which is, and I don't necessarily want to get into like individual pathology, but, there's something to be said for visiting nature, being in kind of wild spaces in broad daylight, which feels to me intuitively like very confronting, as opposed to night. Now, a lot of people would say, well, like nighttime is when you like, are in a tent and you hear all the noises and you're like, there's a more visceral like fear with that, right? But there's a thought when you ask like, what is advice about getting into nature? Like, for me where I live, I could open a window at night and it could be pitch black, and I could hear frogs. And that might be the first step. Like there's an intuitive hit here for me that's like, I wonder if the first step is actually kind of in darkness. If that might feel more comforting and less confronting than kind of broad daylight. Like, what if there wasn't as much light so that I couldn't see it all? Like, if it was just a little bit more sense-based, as in, what am I hearing? What am I smelling? What am I feeling myself touch, et cetera? And I'd be curious about that as an entryway in for people. That it's also really reminiscent then of, what is the womb like?
I was going to say, that feels very womb-like.
Yes,
I get up fairly early in the morning and I let the dog outside, and that's my favorite time because there is something very womb-like about it. And I love hearing the owls. Mm-hmm. We have owls that come visit, and it's my favorite. So mm-hmm. There is something about the darkness that feels very womb-like. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. You know, I want to talk about your latest book, Everything to Remember, which is so stunning. It chronicles this epic camping trip mm-hmm. that you took with your mom after her Alzheimer's diagnosis. And I just wanted to know a bit about your mother and how you would describe your relationship with her before her diagnosis.
Yeah. My mother is a wonderful woman. My relationship with my mom was good. We weren't like best friend, mother-daughter. We didn't have that kind of tightness. But we also didn't have kind of a palpable kind of tension that a lot of mothers and daughters mm-hmm. have. And I didn't feel really kind of pressured by her to fulfill any of her dreams and hopes and, you know, maybe that of her life that went unfulfilled, et cetera. I had from my mother, she was and still is demonstratively warm. That was her primary mode of mothering, was to, mm-hmm. like, I have countless memories of just her body, like a hug, a hand, a touch, a patting on the head, like all through my life. So there was this mm-hmm. kind of physical availability and demonstrative warmth through my life. And there was a lot of consistency and a lot of safety woven into that. And I think what that gave me right from the get-go was maybe what I'd call like nervous system privilege in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that sounds like heaven.
Yeah. That being said, I was a little one, and this is really in the book, that felt a lot of emotion in rooms and felt a lot of mm-hmm. energy in rooms. And no one, including my mother, especially my mother, was able to help me create language for that. And that there was a lot of confusion for me. Mm-hmm. In why am I feeling all of these things and nobody's talking about it and nobody's helping me name it and nobody else is feeling it, you know? So there was a lot of shutting down of different physical feelings for myself, energetic feelings, emotional feelings, et cetera, in order to kind of fit that mold. And I think that created over time, why aren't you explaining a bunch of things to me with words? That created over time a large kind of gap for us. I think there's two other things, is that just in general, what I was seeing in society and certainly inside of my parents' marriage, which was quite a traditional masculine-feminine roles inside of marriage, was a devaluation of the feminine. And so I simultaneously like devalued her because I saw everybody else kind of doing that with the feminine. And so it kind of pushed me in the direction of the masculine, which is a lot of what the first book is about. Mm-hmm. And then Everything Left Remember is like kind of coming back to that feminine. And so I think there was a large devaluation and really a not seeing her. Now, that was kind of no fault of her own. That's a more societal kind of systemic view. And I think the final piece with that is that there were, and this is kind of talked about in the book, there was her own lived experience that created deep, deep shame for her mm-hmm. all around the feminine. And so she didn't have access to that. Like, she didn't give me access to that, but she also didn't have access to that. So there was an even further kind of pull for me to move away from her. Like to separate from her, like a maiden does. We do that archetypally. We have to separate from our mothers. But there was a real kind of devaluation, and I think she also was taught to devalue and carried a lot of shame around the feminine. And so that created a kind of chasm for us mm-hmm. that eventually through the book there was a much deeper exploration of. But that was there was a demonstrative warmth, steadiness, and safety on a multitude of different levels. And a deep generation-long rejection of the feminine.
Yeah, I mean, don't you think we're the first generation that's actually even recognizing that shutdown and the... Yeah, I mean, when you talked about you also kind of pushing that part of your mother away and turning toward the masculine, I mean, I relate to that so much. And it made me very sad. Your book is so beautiful. It's really brought me... to questioning so many things and so much grief within myself. But I'm like, oh, I can see where I've done that with my mother and how I've definitely been more masculine driven in my life. And it's now for the first time, I think I'm recognizing how much I've denied my own feminine and how much the world, especially right now, is denying and has denied the feminine. And it's enraging.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. This was such a huge part of the journey for me. And this is like, was a real kickoff. There was a therapist I was working with who said straight up to me, you know, you think you're bigger than your mother. And I didn't know what that really meant cognitively. I was like, what is, you know, do I think I'm smarter? Do I think I'm more important? Like, what does that even mean? But my body clearly, I mean, it was like my entire physicality was like, uh-huh. So I had to really reckon with that. And a lot of this for me, I think about this with my mother. I think about this with archetypal mother. And I think about this with Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. This kind of right sizing of she came first. And there were burdens that that generation had to carry that I think sometimes our generation doesn't always see. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't hurts, that there weren't things that were mistakes made, that there weren't, there wasn't pain caused. But, you know, I often think about it when I think about my mom's generation and her mom as well, what they had to bury, just straight up bury, to make it through, and what our generation now has to unearth to kind of bring that back to life. Now, when I think about that in regards to just my individual mother-daughter relationship, there's a lot of anger, right? You, like, as you said, like I get enraged at that and I get enraged at society. Now, but when I pull that out in a time frame and look at that from a lineage standpoint, long-term, I actually think there might be kind of like a mystic technique of, okay, this generation's going to bury the treasure. And that is their job and their kind of sacred contract. And it is going to be painful. And their daughters are going to be very mad at them for that. And their daughters have a sacred contract of unearthing that. And that's going to anger some of the previous generation who had to kind of keep their mouths shut for a long time. What do you mean? You're the generation that can now talk about this. And, you know, I mean, that's terrifying.
All right. On that intense note, we are going to cut away for a brief break, but we'll be right back with more Steph Jacker.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty, beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Welcome back, my friends. Steph was just breaking down the multi-generational, multifaceted, and multi-layered concept of the mother-daughter bond.
But when I think about it from that lineage kind of, what am I looking at over 250, 300 years? I actually think, gosh, I have a lot of gratitude for the generations before for what they buried in a kind of mystical, unconscious attempt to keep safe.
I love that. I love that perspective. I've never thought of it in that way. And yeah, I definitely have been able to find the gratitude for my mother and for everything you just said of the burying. But it's sometimes, along with the anger, it's sometimes really hard to like rest in that gratitude.
Of course, of course. It's like a both and. This is where all this nuance comes in, right? Like there's lived experience and then there's like, you know, the mythopoetic version. Right. And it's like, okay, some days if I've had too much coffee, I'm probably in the lived experience version. And if I'm like, you know, have meditated all morning, I'm the mythopoetic. And, you know, we dance in those spaces.
Yeah, totally. I want to talk about your mother's Alzheimer's for, you know, people out there who may have relatives that may be experiencing this. Maybe they might be experiencing some things themselves. What were some of the signs, the signposts, I guess, along the way?
Yeah. There's a lot, and they're very different. You know, there's dementia is kind of the larger umbrella. Alzheimer's is one of the kind of spokes underneath it. And there's multiple other forms of kind of cognitive decline. And, you know, for my mother, there was a lot of early things, missing names, you know, for just general forgetfulness about certain things, et cetera. But the real, you know, when you walk across the street and there's a hand flashing that says, if it's like green, you can walk. There's a person walking and then it starts to flash a hand. Like she started to get confused about those types of things, which is, you know, we know this stuff from when we're preschoolers. So there was a general confusion, general forgetfulness, really forgetful with names and dates and places, that type of thing. The main tip off for me, I remember I was driving with her in a car one day and we were having a conversation and I asked her a question and she said something that immediately enraged me. Like I was kind of like, I cannot, but I was so mad. And I got out of the car. She was dropping me off at a friend's place. And I got out of the car and it was my best friend. And I immediately start launching into this story about how awful my mother is, right? Like, I'm just like, I can't believe my mother just said this, blah, blah, blah. And partway through the story, I stopped and I was like, wait, that's not my mother. Like, that's not something she would normally do or say. Like, that is so far outside of the realm. Like, my mom was a very, like, if you don't have anything nice to say, you don't say anything at all. And she was quite silent. She wouldn't really express kind of an opinion, especially an opinion that was harsh or blunt. You know, that was just her.
Right.
So when she said that, I just remember thinking, and I turned to my friend and I said, something's wrong with my mom. And it, in that moment, just all of the puzzle pieces, the forgetting the names, the general forgetfulness, all of the things that I mentioned before, just kind of click, 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 click. And I went, okay, whoa, something's wrong. I think that shifting in personality is a very interesting sign. And it's often confusing because we're talking about, you know, 2/3 of the people diagnosed with Alzheimer's are women. And so we're talking about a lot of women who are, you know, in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, which is also, you know, menopause. And there are a lot of shifts in our personalities and in our moods and in our, you know, and so sometimes it's really tough to decipher. Like, am I feeling brain foggy and forgetful and a little bit off and more moody because I'm going through a massive hormonal change? And how am I talking to my doctor about that? Or, you know, is something going on with my brain? I mean, that's a tricky kind of thing. So those shifts in personality and general forgetfulness, I think, are really, really important in that age to pay attention to.
That, I mean, to be honest, like I'll be 40 in August and I have a lot of those symptoms because my hormones are changing.
Yes, same.
And having to learn to work with that. Yep. Yeah, I have a lot of brain fog and a lot of like, I'll walk into a room and forget why I walked into the room. And so when I was reading about this, and I have had concern until I started to recognize that these are these can be hormonal changes.
Yes,
and
they can.
This is what happens. I did have concern. I was like, what's happening to my mind? I used to be so clear. And so, yes, I totally, when I was reading this book, I was like, oh, yeah. And sometimes I wonder if that feels like a precursor to something that could be going or it could happen in the future. So it's definitely something as we go through these years to keep an eye on big time.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, our hormones play, there's a lot of research coming out that are that hormonal support and, you know, through the ages of 40 and 50 can make a mm-hmm. big difference on our long-term brain health. So that's an important, I just really think like, I've thought that a lot this year. I turned 40 last year and it is top of mind. You know, what can I do now for any inflammation, for cognitive health, for hormonal mm-hmm. health, et cetera, as I look at really what is a lineage, because my grandmother had dementia as well, lived well into her 90s. But, you know, this is inside of our family for sure.
How old's your mom now?
My mom is going to be 75 this August.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. August birthday.
Yeah.
So you did just mention your mother's mother had dementia.
Yes.
And so what was your mom's role in taking care of her? And did your mom ever look at her and think this could be me ever?
As I said earlier, my mom was a woman of few words. And so there was not a time where I ever heard her say, oh shit, I'm feeling these similar things. But as I look back at the timelines, I just think how absolutely excruciating. So my grandmother had, as I said, old age dementia. She lived on her own. Well into her 80s and was then moved into a care facility in her 90s. My mom and her sisters played kind of rotating roles of care. They would go and visit her. You know, there was one sister in basically daily. You know, one helped more with groceries, one helped with walking her beloved dog, one helped with, you know, balancing the checkbook, you know, various different things. And my grandmother died 6 months after my mother's diagnosis. So there was most definitely a year or 2 year period of time where my mother was showing signs and knew she was showing signs. We were having active conversations about it while her mother was in a steep decline. Mm. And I can't imagine, I mean, again, these weren't spoken, but I look back and I think no wonder there was such a huge resistance to go to the doctor to get any sort of diagnosis, because you're just watching. It just would have been excruciating. And I think also for her sisters to kind of, you know, to see the two of them at the end of my grandmother's life, you know, in those 6 months to a year before my grandmother passed, to see the two of them together was just, it was awful. They just, their conversations were just nothing. It was really excruciating. So I can only imagine that my mom found that to be difficult. And I know my mom used to get very frustrated. I do remember one time I went with her to help balance my grandmother's checkbook. My mom started to get very frustrated, very bossy, very domineering, kind of like just kind of shut up and do this, you know? And my grandmother turned to me and said, she doesn't like taking care of me. And my mom was kind of like, it's not that, mom. It's, you know, but there was a lot of moments of high frustration in that relationship. And that also wasn't my mom. I mean, I can only assume that was because she was also kind of locking eyes with what was going on in her own body.
Yeah. Yeah. And when there's no words spoken about that, that's got to be a deep internal experience.
Yeah.
Very, very confusing. You know, it's so interesting when you started to talk about the change in your mother's personality. One of the things you talk about in the book, though, was the picture that you took of your mother by the horse. And there was this like beautiful change in her personality, too, where she was standing in a different way that she would have never stood. And I just found it started to bring up a question in me of like, do you think Alzheimer's actually gives or brings out some of the shadowier pieces of us, things that we've repressed, and actually gives it an opportunity to speak in some way. Like that's what came to me when I read that. It was just interesting.
Yes, absolutely. I think for better or worse, I mean, there's a lot of stories of people who maybe have spent a life repressing anger where Alzheimer's shows up and there's a period of time where then there's, you know, really large outbursts of anger. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when I think about Alzheimer's, and again, you know, I move from the lived experience of the excruciating, you know, day-to-day and the grief and the loss. And then I move to a lens of kind of something that is more, that I try to do that's more expansive and kind of lineage-based and maybe mythopoetic, is to kind of think, this is a disease that is allowing this person's or changing this person's time, space, reality constantly. Mm-hmm. And so in one moment she might be 107 and in one moment she might be 7 or 17 mm-hmm. or, you know. And if I can actively grieve and move into the center of grief, move into the kind of eye of the hurricane mm-hmm. and allow her reality to her time, space, reality to shift instead of trying to force her to share mine, like to correct her and say, no, mom, it's this, that's going to cause frustration.
Right.
And this is for anybody with any sort of neurodiversity, by the way, mm-hmm. that then if you're allowing that person to have that reality and you're doing your own grief work to kind of meet them there, I think what you're shown in that place is nothing short of magic. There's a quote, this was in an interview I heard with Brandi Carlile. She said, mysticism is the most practical thing in the world. The only thing about it is it found smack in the middle of grief. And I think, gosh, if we can summon the courage to grieve what we're losing, to say she is losing the reality of her being able to recognize me, I'm going to grieve that and I'm going to walk further in, then what I'm going to see in that place is this woman in this coquettish stance with this horse, like with this, this grace that I had never seen her have before. All those times that I would have said, like, I wish I knew my mom as a 16-year-old. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, if you're willing to move past your own grief and your own ego and your own identity, you will get a glimpse of that. Yeah. And so there are a lot of, I think, gifts. I mean, I've seen more of my mother in her disappearance. Mm-hmm. And again, it's the relinquishing of the roles, right? Like, she doesn't have to be my mother. She doesn't have to play the role as my mother. So who will I get to see? I'll get to see a friend. I'll get to see a 16-year-old. I'll get to see a flirtatious woman standing in the horse pasture. I'll get to see, you know, all of these different things, which inside of the mother-daughter role, there's a constriction there.
Yeah. I mean, when I hear that, like, I wish that for every woman, not the Alzheimer's piece, but I wish that every woman could experience the presence of themselves and the playfulness of being all of these complexities and that we are, because we are such complex creatures that do carry around such a one-dimensional version of ourselves that we think we have to present. And that's what I heard. For me, it's like, oh, there seemed to be a beautiful gift, if we can find the gifts in these horrible situations, of she got to be whoever she wanted to be, because it was in that moment, it's just very present.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I've been fascinated by before all of this, before my mother was diagnosed, I was fascinated by shape-shifting. You know, the idea of shape-shifters within mythology, et cetera. And then all of a sudden she's diagnosed and I'm like, I've got a slow motion shape-shifting. It's like, I can watch a hummingbird's wings move slowly. Like, I have this gift of being able to watch this. Now, there's going to be parts of it that are absolutely excruciating that I do not want to endure, that I do not want to see. But there's also other parts of it that I'm like, oh, you were fascinated by shape-shifting? Well, here you are. Mm-hmm. If you are able to say yes to this, you can witness kind of a slow-motion shape-shifting. And that takes some courage to do. Mm-hmm. But there are gifts inside of that.
Yeah, that seems like a life lesson of, like, where do we place our focus? Because that seems like, you know, that seems like that could be in any kind of situation of the rough parts of things. And then there's all of these beautiful gifts that we will miss if we're completely stuck in the negativity of the situation. And when I hear you talk about that, that's like, that's a big life lesson of where are you placing your focus?
That's exactly it. And we usually place it where there's pain or something pinched.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is exactly where we're going to pause for a brief break, but we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, we are going to give women meaningful beauty. And I said, that's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life.
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. And right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hello again, loves. Steph was just breaking down the profound and beautiful lessons that come from painful and uncomfortable situations.
I think we actually do need to place it there to kind of get through. Mm-hmm. But can you, as you're focusing on the initial pain or pinched area, can you add in a curiosity? What else is here? Why is this pinched? How does this need to be loved or tended to or nurtured so that I can move into the center of it as opposed to kind of walking around it and saying, you shouldn't be here. I hate you for being here.
Right.
You know, and yeah. Never kind of touching it. You know, there has to be, there's got to be a kind of a curiosity that's included in that, which mm-hmm. which is hard. That's a hard thing.
Yeah, it is a hard thing. I find myself walking around things often.
Yeah.
until I finally do land in the middle of it. And when you do, it's like, oh, the finally not resisting it is what allows things to move, is allows yeah. things to open up. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned grief because grief is, it's funny, we've been touching upon grief on every episode of this podcast this season.
Of course,
yeah. I mean, you can't be alive, I think, right now without feeling some level of grief. And for those of us who feel so deeply, I feel like I wake up every day with it so heavy on my heart and try to find ways to be able to not ignore it.
Yeah.
Like to allow it to move because yes, it's there.
Yes.
You know, like with your grief around this, like how is your understanding of grief changed through your mother's diagnosis?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful question. I think of grief as a suite of emotions. It's not a singular emotion. It feels to me like many of them at once. There might be pain, there might be sorrow, there might be sadness, rage. There also might be relief and gratitude and hopefulness and love inside of it. I think this might sound strange or I, you know, maybe even like unattainable, and certainly can feel that way a little bit to me. But to be quite frank, I think it's one of the most beautiful things in the human experience, because
grief.
There's an ache to grief that is not unlike a thaw. And you know, when your fingertips are frozen and they begin to thaw, and there's this just a searing pain. There's like a searing kind of thumping pain in your fingertips, And it's not, it feels not dissimilar to that for me, that there's this great thaw happening. Mm-hmm. And when I think of something thawing and I think of it moving from a state of firmness into fluidity, I am hopeful. And so if we are able to actually step into grief and surrender kind of to it, then I think we're capable of the whole range of all of the other human emotions involved in the human experience, which means we can live life in a state of kind of aliveness.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we think about grief, I think we mostly pair it with death, right? And it is paired with death, but it could be death metaphorical of all different kinds, a loss of a job or a loss of a parent, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think inside of our society, that's the master initiation is life, death, life, right? Mm-hmm. So in our society, we try to push grief and death off, thinking we will just have ever increased capitalistic kind of life moving in a linear direction, more and more and more life.
Right.
Now, that doesn't happen. What that does is it suspends the initiation and it moves us into living death, which is the freeze.
Oh, wow. Well, wait, say that again.
Right. So if we push death and grief off and say, we don't have time for that, I don't want to feel that, we think it's going to lead to more living.
Right.
But what it does is it suspends an initiation and causes living death. That's the freeze state. I'm concretized. I'm frozen. There's metastasization that happens in that place.
Right.
We think it's more life, but it is not. And so for us to kind of go, okay, let's look at nature. Like, that's like saying, okay, fall, winter, you can't exist.
Right. Exactly.
You're not allowed.
Yeah.
And so things would die. Things would actually die. And so I think we've got to get more and more comfortable with this. And I think one of the, I mean, obviously the relationship with grief is like ongoing with my mom.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I think one of the things that's been most helpful for me with this is, I believe his name is pronounced Martin Prechtel. And he wrote a book called Rain on Dust, and it is about grief and praise and really how so many cultures outside of the Western world have an element of grieving that is praise, is how we sing hallelujah, you know, how we wail and chant, and there's quite a sound to it actually. And, you know, you know this as a singer, there's times where you're singing about love, right? There's times that you're singing about love, but there's this pain that's parallel, you know, in a voice. And to me, that's grief. It's not just love. It's the combination of grief and praise. Like, thank God I felt this person, had this thing, and you know, maybe they're gone, but there's something so beautiful there. And I think it's a quintessential human experience that we really try and push away. And I think it's time for us to start. And as you said, it's wonderful. I love, you know, that all of the conversations this year have been around grief. We're seeing this in the literary world, we're seeing this in so many different places. That it's really time for us to go, like, and this is, you know, Catherine May's book, Wintering. You know, I think this is why it's been so successful, because it's like, right, when do we rest? When do we go dormant? When do we say goodbye? When do we, you know, gather and sing and be in ceremony and really honor and be in awe of what we were able to have in this season of our life, so as to allow it to come to a completion and then, you know, move into a stage of renewed life, of rebirth.
Wow. Yeah, that was beautiful. Is there anything that, any practice or anything that have felt has supported you in your grief and to be able to get in touch with that piece of you more?
Absolutely. I would say that ceremony and ritual are a really, really important part of my grieving process. And I want to make this as accessible as possible. This is not some like formal thing where there's a, you must do it this way. I think when people hear about ceremony and ritual, they're like, okay, like what are the 10 rules
I
have to follow?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. And it's like, no, this has been a very, free kind of made up process for me. So as an example, my mother was moved into a care facility in the summer of 2020, in Canada. I live in the US. I couldn't go. And in fact, nobody could go because of COVID.
she was just kind of dropped off outside and then no one could go in with her, you know?
Yeah.
So I couldn't be there. And I thought, this is a day full of grief. What do I do? And so I said, I'm going to cancel everything. I'm going to move into ceremony. And I walked around my property. I grabbed a big branch. I had a couple of raven feathers that a friend gave me. I poured some tea. I basically kind of used nature all around me and had music playing, had candles. Like any ceremony or ritual to me is like all of my senses. You know, how am I embodying this? That's what I'm trying to do. Is I could try and think my way through this, but that's not what my brain's made for. That's my brain's made for taxes. That's about it. I need to feel my way through this. Mm-hmm. And so I need to recruit all of my different senses and have them be present. And let me make something, let me create something, let me offer something. And it's made up. Who knows, you know? And I love to talk about that because I want to make that kind of process really accessible for people to be like, a ceremony could be you lighting a candle, jumping up and down 10 times and lying on the ground.
Like, right.
What, you know,
it can be whatever you want.
It can be whatever
which
you want.
Which I think is really interesting. I love that you just brought this up because this has been something that I've been playing with, is this sense of play in my life, because I didn't have it as a child very much. I was forced into working. And so play for me, and when I was really young, like ceremony and being with nature, and that was such a huge part of my world. I was an only child. I made up stories all the time. Like it was just such a massive part of my world. And I've been starting to find a return to that in some way. Once again, that resistance to nature and ceremony, actually. I love ceremony. And it's like you just said, I want someone to give me the 10 steps. I don't want to have to make things up because I feel like I'm quote unquote doing it wrong. And it really is this form. I know that it's asking me to play.
Yeah. I mean, most of us know, if we do know of ceremony and ritual, we know about it in religious contexts. And first of all, most women weren't allowed to be in those types of ceremonies. If they were, there was a way to do it and you could mess it up and get it wrong.
Right.
And so to really remove it from that and say like, no, you can play. And I love that you've said play, because this kind of ties back to the nervous system, this really embodied kind of way of processing grief or processing a moment in our lives. Play is a kind of nervous system blend of fear and curiosity.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Wait,
like there's...
Why fear in play?
Because you're doing something unknown, risky. There's excitement. You know, there's that pendulum of excitement through fear. We're kind of right on, like, I've never gone on a swing that high before.
Right.
I've never like jumped in a pool and done a cannonball. I've never played in a sandbox before. Am I going to get it in my underwear? Like, you just don't know. There's a little bit of like, it involves a vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And anytime there's a vulnerability, there's these little elements of fear. And so adding it, making it and moving it to play is, let's get curious about this. Mm-hmm. Right. So as little kids, you know, you imagine a little kid maybe nervous to walk. I mean, you read about this in the book, nervous to walk into school, right? Nervous nervous to be the one to do the sports day race or to sing a song or to paint the picture or whatever. There's nervousness. There's a little element of vulnerability and fear. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, you know, our nervous system doesn't know what, you know, that's a scary state. I could shut down. I could freeze. I could, you know, a whole bunch of different things. But the minute I add in wonder, awe, curiosity, what's going to happen here, et cetera, is a really, really beautiful state for our nervous systems to find safety within some of those bordering on fear moments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love that I'm just about to embark on a new tour. And I've had so much anxiety around it because there's so much unknown. We're still putting everything together and it doesn't really come together till I step foot, you know, we all step foot on stage.
On stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there is this, I've been really trying to, because there's, you know, it's the both end. It's like, I trust and know myself so well. And I know that everything will work out for its highest good. And I also have this complete fear and anxiety around it. And you just described that so perfectly for me.
Yes.
I'm like, it's just my nervous system not knowing what to do with it.
Exactly. And where's the slipstream between those two places, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I would love for you, you know, to discuss, you know, losing your mother while she's still alive. Like, how has that affected your relationship with her? And when I look at my own parents, you know, I went through a lot with my parents. I've been through, and we don't have very close relationships. And I've often think of how much grief I've had around them already. How I don't look forward to them passing away because it's like the second round of grief.
Yes, yes.
And so when I think of your situation, I relate in a lot of ways, not that, you know, I don't have the daily death and grief with them, but I totally relate to that feeling of the grieving before the grieving, if that makes sense. And before we explore that thought any further, we're going to take a quick pause, but we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, "We are going to give women meaningful beauty." And I said, "That's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life."
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. And right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Welcome back, loves. Steph and I were just diving into the multiple layers of grief that come with our parental relationships as we age.
There's current grief. There's anticipatory grief.
Yeah.
And I think also for a lot of us with our parents, especially if relationships have been fraught or tense, is then when we think about them dying, there's a grief of the actual loss. But there's also a grief of, I think if parents are still living and there's been a tension in the relationship, there's always some internal part of us that's hoping it might change. Like one day they might be able to do this. One day I might be able to have this relationship. And then if and when they go, there's a grief of like, oh, I actually never am going to get that. I'm going to grieve this person, and I'm going to grieve the fact that I was holding out hope maybe in some way, shape, and form. So for me, you know, the experience has been, again, how do I think maybe this is all of us. Like, how do I allow myself to move through and mature through life, you know, maiden, mother, autumn queen, crone? How do I move through those things with some sort of like grace? And if I am going to move through those things and come into mother and kind of ask the quintessential question of archetypal mother for me is, what will I allow to be created through me? And that could be human lives, or that could be creative projects, or that could, you know, lots of different things. But what will I allow to be created through me? Now, I also have to understand that as I move into that role, I have to release her from archetypal mother so she can move into her next stage of life. I think what we try and do is demand that they stay there. And especially if there's been things that are incomplete or we feel are incomplete. Instead of saying, I'm going to move into mother, I'm going to mother myself, I'm going to mother my creative projects, I'm going to mother children, et cetera, and I'm going to allow her to move into Autumn Queen Crone. And that may take different shapes and forms. And so for me, with my mother, there's really been a question of how do I allow her to go on this journey, which is going to be the disappearance, slow disappearance of her. And what will my relationship to myself, like she's going to kind of drop the mirror that of my own identity that she's reflecting back to me. Some people had that mirror dropped when they were 14 years old and their mother is still around, right? But then there becomes a question of, am I going to pick it up? Who am I going to ask to hold it? How do I hold it for myself? How do I use nature to hold it with me? And so that's an ongoing question for me of how am I actively mothering, remothering self? And how am I actively surrendering and allowing her, you know, to move into different roles? I think there's also something really interesting, you know, as we talk archetypally kind of about maiden, mother, Autumn Queen, Crone. I talk to a lot of women in their, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, et cetera, that have, you know, pretty big mama wound, right?
Right.
And I always like to reflect back, like I'll ask them like, so you're talking about the situation when you were 10, how old was your mom when she had you? Okay. She was, you know, 20. So she was 35 at the time. Like you know, it'd be like everyone, like we're kind of going like, oh, I'm a 40, 50, 60, 7-year-old woman.
Right.
And I really have got to learn how to step into remothering because I'm talking about the wounds that happened and occurred with me. When she was 25 to 35, like younger than I am now. Like I don't know about you, but I don't feel like a fully formed human yet.
No. I mean, 40, like I can't believe that I'm going to be 40 soon. Right. And it's like, wait, I don't. And then what's really interesting about age is like, I remember being really young and 40 was old.
Right.
And now I look at 40, I'm like, 40's so young and 60's not even old. Like
We're still making mistakes. We're still learning how to apologize. We're still learning where our egos are at. We're still like, you know, all of these things. And so I often reflect back and I'm like, oh my gosh, right. Like my mom was only 32 then, or she was only 34 then, like, or she was 28, like when she made that horrible mistake that impacted me. You're like, okay, again, we've got to have people take responsibility and we've got to have boundaries, you know, appropriate boundaries for ourselves inside of those relationships. But there is this kind of perspective of, oh, we've got to really let women move also into these Autumn Queen and kind of crone archetypes. I could talk a lot about archetypes. I won't go into it, but I think that's been one of the ways, as you ask about like what's my own grieving process as I move through this, is to allow myself to fully land inside of the archetype of mother so that as I lose her, I gain my own mothering of self.
Yeah. Wow. What a journey. That's a definite journey. And I know I'm definitely stepping into mother more for myself. You know, I don't have children of my own. I have two stepsons, but I have learned that the more and more I step into mother myself, like the more I am feeling like the wholeness of womanhood.
Yes.
Yeah, which is really beautiful. And it is such a journey. You talk a lot about in this book about the splitting off of self. I mean, I think everybody can relate to that, but every woman, especially, you know, your mother's lack of emotion, a lack of words around that, really played a huge part in that piece for you as a child. Like how has finding your own words, like how has that changed your life and how has that created more wholeness for you?
Yeah, the main way I would answer that is that it's helped me remember. And I often like to use
the word remember spelt R-E-member, as in remember.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Like if we move like through that. Our lives and we split off from ourselves, we reject, say, the feminine, or we reject the personality that's too much, or a part of us that might be direct, that as little girls we're told that's bossy and rude. Okay, that's got to be rejected and split off from. We dismember ourselves. And so I think for me, there's always been, this is just part of who I am, a real thirst for a translation of those experiences, and a translation through felt sense and words. And that's, I think, having those words and having an ability to kind of like walk into those wordless spaces and attempt to translate something there has kind of helped me move through that process of remembering, of bringing those dismembered parts kind of back to self. Mm-hmm. And this is, I mean, I could talk about, mythological examples. This is the story of original creation, the myth of Isis and Osiris, dismembering and remembering of self. And it's a divinely, divinely feminine act to go and gather the dismembered parts and say they belong back together, and to create, this is womb-like, to create a spaciousness, even though it might be dark or chaotic or confusing. And to kind of create that spaciousness and a translation for that remembering of self.
Yeah, I mean, I love that you said, even though it may be dark, yeah, there's a messiness to it that that we have to be able, it's like, I think about, you know, looking at grief and then looking at our own mess and how we have, both of those seem very similar to me in that we have to go into the darkness in order to bring those pieces back into wholeness.
Yeah,
and it's not pretty sometimes.
Exactly. I think this is the feminine gift. I think one of the most harmful things, I think, from a patriarchal standpoint, is to tell women to be neat and tidy. Like, you have to be this way. You have to look this way. You have to be this way. You have to behave this way. You have to be clean and neat and tidy and perfect. Because there is a very natural, this is the womb, a natural kind of place of pure potential that is only sense-based. It's dark and all you can hear is a, you know, heartbeat, is a drumbeat. And so where is the dark cavern that I can descend into? Where am I allowed to descend and get messy and, you know, all of these things? But that's, you know, there's so much inside of that we're often told we should be afraid of that. We should be afraid of that kind of woman. That kind of woman is evil. That kind of woman, you know, all of this type of stuff. So this is where it kind of circles, does a full circle into nature. It's like, that's where I mirrored the ferality, you know, the wilderness of my own interior, of the messiness of the parts of me that howl, of the part, you know, all of those parts that society kind of deems is not an acceptable woman. Is really actually our gift that we've been kept from. And and the people who can descend into that place and who can surrender to that glorious mess are often the people that come out with a new creation, with new life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that new life is possible without that, right? Yeah. I would think.
Yeah.
What is this journey with your mother? You talk about surrender. What has it taught you about surrender? Like, what does it look and feel like to you to be fully surrendered into something?
It feels very out of control. It feels, I mean, you know, I think about my mom, she had five children in total. That's a lot of creation.
And that is a lot of creation.
It's a lot of creation. And I think about, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, I just read this beautiful essay about mother, archetypal mother, as really kind of an annihilation of self, that you have to be both visible and invisible at once as a mother. And I think about that, again, I don't have children, so I think about that in the creative process. How am I both visible? So for you, for example, you are you and you're standing on a stage and it's your name and there you are, you're visible, all eyes on you. And you're embodied and you're there. And what part of you is invisible enough to allow something else to come through you? What part of you have you been able to kind of get spacious about and move. It's like a flute, you know, that you can turn yourself into that, that you're like, I am here. I can feel my butt in this seat. I can feel a guitar in my hand. I can feel, I'm typing something out as a writer. Mm-hmm. And I can also feel there's like an invisibility of me that something else is pouring through.
Mm-hmm.
And you could call that a flow state, sure. To me, that is a surrendered act of creation, and it's archetypal mother.
Wow. Yeah, I never have thought about how much surrender, I guess, it takes to allow for creativity to flow through, to be that, to be on the receiving end, to be penetrated by.
To be a vessel. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it feels like, yeah, there are so many pieces of myself that I have to move slightly out of the way.
Right.
That's, in order for that to come through.
That's the question. And if you move too much of yourself out of the way, then it could be a kind of disembodied, or you're not there. You annihilate too much of yourself. And then it's like,
yes,
wow,
I've been there too.
that's a tough thing. And so how do we continue to grow the capacity from a nervous system standpoint, from an embodiment somatic standpoint, to be mm-hmm. in our flesh, to occupy our bodies at the yes. same time as disappear ourselves? And perhaps I mean mostly like the mental self.
Right, enough, it is the mental, yeah, totally.
Enough to have, to actually use the instrument, the human instrument, to run enough energy to create things.
I love it. I just have a couple more quick questions. Yeah. I just wonder what do you want people to take away from your book and your story?
Mm. It's a tough, I don't know if I have any specific, like, I want you to get this. I want people to find something for themselves inside of it, I suppose, without it being dictated by me. I mean, I think that's a quintessential mother. Like, I want you to have your experience, and I don't mm-hmm. want to put my hopes and dreams over top of it. Right. I'm gonna hold those for me, and that feels complete within the creative process. And then I'm gonna release you to go in the book to go and be mm-hmm. what you are gonna be. I do know that my mom's energy is in this book, and so there is. I think for some people, they're gonna feel that as a kind of her demonstrative warmth comes through. I think there's a, like, how is it that you break something apart so much, but I still feel held? You know, that's, I think that energy is inside of the book. I also think, you know, our world right now is pretty hell-bent on talking about all of the things that are falling apart, our political systems, our environmental systems, our business systems. You know, there's a lot of things that we're watching crumble. Mm-hmm. It's terrifying. It's very scary. All of the things that we thought, this is the thing that's going to hold me, that's going to keep me safe, this financial system, this job, this, all the stuff. And I think as we watch things crumble, including the natural world, and this is for me with my mom, I'm watching her fall apart. This is the person I thought would, hold me safe and be there. I think it's important for us to point that out, those things out. This is happening. Mm-hmm. This is going on. And for us to create plans and actions and all of these different things. But I also think we need to be held. I think we need to be told and whispered to and sung songs to that say, we're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, even when we're not. Mm-hmm. And I feel that in this book.
Completely.
And that's so very much my mother. That's very much her.
I love that. I love that you honor her in this book and her mm-hmm. energy, and that mm-hmm. it comes through. It's so stunning. I have one last question about music, because of course, yes, I ask every guest what their holy five songs are. They could be from, it could be from right now in your life, or it could be from forever, whatever moves you. I would love to know.
You know, Leanne, I was thinking about this because I knew you were going to ask.
Question.
I know, it's so hard. It's so hard. I was like, okay, I'm going to make this. And you know what? I'm a Canadian. I'm a Canadian, true and true. And so my list is Canadian.
Cool.
My five songs are, they're both Canadian, but Katie Lang's version of Hallelujah, especially live.
Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
That's quite
so
something.
Good.
Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now, is a big one.
That song breaks my heart.
It's cloud illusions, I recall, I really
don't know clouds at all.
It breaks my heart,
in
right?
The best of ways, yes.
Sarah McLachlan Angel is a big one for me. Yes. That's so like high school. I don't know.
Fly from this star cold hotel room and the endlessness that you feel.
Total high school.
Right? I could not have a list of Canadian music if I did not have the Tragically Hip. So Boots or Hearts is a big one for me. I love that song.
I don't know that song. Oh my gosh, I have to go look it up.
But even babies raised by wolves and know exactly when they've been used. See when it's dark, fall apart, man, really falls apart.
There's a lot of amazing hip songs, but that's a big one. And a more current one, Lee Fallback, Into the Ether. I love that song.
Maybe find something you can dance to and hold on to something you know is true and slip into the ether.
Love that song.
Yeah.
That's like heaven. Yeah.
Yeah.
Aw, thank you. Thank you for sharing your heart. Thank you. It was so nice to finally see your face and meet you.
Right.
I know. And thank you for just traveling this journey with me for this past hour so eloquently. It was stunning. I learned so much from you. So thank you for being here.
Well, you are very good at this, and it is my honor and privilege to be witness to and participate in.
Thank you. And that wraps up this episode of Holy Human. I want to thank Steph Jagger so much for joining me. It was such a beautiful conversation. And I highly recommend her hauntingly beautiful and moving new memoir, Everything Left to Remember. I found it profoundly moving, and I'm sure you all will too, especially after this conversation. And please leave me your thoughts about today's episode or anything else in the comments where you're listening, because I love connecting and hearing from you all. So send me your thoughts. On our next Holy Human, I will be joined by Bree Malaysen, a spiritual facilitator with a surprisingly practical approach to tapping into the transformative power of your true potential. By tuning in to your intuition, into your soul. I think you'll find her way of viewing our spirituality and purpose really unique and refreshing and very insightful. So until then, please take care of yourself and each other, and I love you.
Holy Human with me, Leanne Rimes, is a production of iHeartRadio. You'll find Holy Human with Leanne Rimes on the iHeart app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get the podcasts that matter most to you.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-errands pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Turns out, a delightfully clean home can make for a delightful start to the day. At Mrs. Meyer's, everything they make is inspired by the garden. With plant-derived and other thoughtfully chosen ingredients, their cleaning products smell like a dream and work like the dickens, leaving your home sparkly clean and your to-do list tackled in no time. Goodness, there's no better feeling than that. Mrs. Meyer's, rooted in goodness. Visit MrsMeyers.com today.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just two capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.